I'm here in my capacity as the director of the Center for Corporate Commercial Law, and I'd like to welcome you to today's seminar. It's great to see such a healthy turnout, which is great. Our speaker today is Professor Stefan Grundmann, a highly distinguished academic corporate and commercial lawyer. He's professor of private and business law at Humboldt University in Berlin. He's also currently a fellow at the European University Institute and will shortly take up a professorship there. He's a widely renowned expert in commercial law, corporate law, and private law more generally. He's written monographs and commentaries on banking law, contract law, corporate law, and investment fund contracts, if that wasn't enough. Professor Grundmann is in Cambridge here for just over a week. He is here as part of the academic visitor scheme that the law firm Herbert Smith Freehills generously sponsors. While Professor Grundmann is here, he doesn't just get to do this, he also has the honor slash burden of joining myself and MCL students who are doing comparative corporate governance. He's joining us for three sessions, which is great. Any indication of the base of the first session, highly rewarding contribution. Today, Professor Grundmann, as you can see here, is going to talk about transnational groups of companies, and he's going to speak for about 35 to 40 minutes. He knows he went a little longer when he was practicing, but he wants questions, and so he will round things off. And then, unfortunately, there are people coming in at 2, so we need to be concerned about time. Not concerned, but aware of time. Thanks for coming.
Now, thank you very much for the introduction, distinguished colleagues, ladies and gentlemen. It's always a pleasure and indeed a great honor to come to Cambridge. Of course, the famous Oxbridge is known all over Europe, and though it may not be very significant, one of the universities has 2 characters, the other one has 6, and therefore I may perhaps as well greet all those in the UK who are interested in transnational groups of companies. It's a non-topic, really. Group of companies in the UK, outside Germany, nobody speaks about it. And even in Germany, it's a very old-fashioned topic. So why should one want to speak about groups of companies any longer? You know that in Germany, some time ago, in 65, a law of group of companies was enacted, but that is half a century ago. Then some German scholars spoke about it in the late 90s, the Forum Europaeum, with international lawyers as well, a little bit, but it was basically considered to be a German enterprise. And then the Reflection Group of 2011 speaks about it again a bit, but nevertheless, it seems to be a very old-fashioned question, the transnational group of companies. Now, as Professor Cheffins has said, I focus on several areas of the law. Yesterday he has said, well, all-rounder in all areas and specialize in all areas. I think I specialize perhaps in the intersections, really, and I would say this this talk today is about 2 intersections, mainly perhaps 3 intersections. The one is really company and contract, which is an intersection you do not find so often. You're in academia, but as well in the legislative bodies, the discussion is basically either on the company law side or on the contract law side. You don't find them together, although the famous Nobel Prize winning article by Ronald Coase already in 1937 asked us the question, market and firm, do they interact, are they alternatives or so? And in this respect, perhaps the group of companies is quite interesting, more interesting than its image would suggest. Now, and the second intersection would be legal scholarship and social theory. Of course, we are working on an interdisciplinary scale nowadays, and I would say Cambridge is certainly one, if not the most prestigious university in the law school here. Social theory is a stronghold in Cambridge. Now, if as legal scholars we say it's a non-topic, social theory would say, oh, it's the avant-garde, really, of what is transnational thinking, really, in sociology of economics. But in economics as well, you would say, oh, it's a very hot and very new topic. Now, these two intersections make the topic perhaps already a bit more interesting. I termed it in a legal way, transnational group of companies. An economist would probably say it's the multinational enterprise. A political scientist would say it's the new states. The power is really residing in these groups of companies. And the subtitle is Patchwork World and Pieces of Theory, because of course there are different disciplines, so it's pieces really of theories. An economist would probably say we have one model which dominates all that, and of course the law has to follow it to a certain extent. So it's a different approach, but not blind to other disciplines, but nevertheless independent from the legal perspective. What will I do? I will speak about the topic a little bit, what is really interesting in it, and then say, give an overall map with different regulatory areas. It's not just one law of groups. There are different areas, and I want to tell you which ones are heavily regulated, which ones not, and exemplify all that with three cases, all taken from Germany, all big enterprises, Volkswagen being one, Daimler being the other one, and in order not only to sell cars, I thought that Siemens might be a beautiful one as well. And at the end, I will try to wrap up and say some pieces of theory. Now, the interesting thing is the dominant form of organization in practice are groups of companies, and nevertheless we speak so little in legal theory about it. I could give you now a lot of figures. Share of total net income and so on. But we have 35 minutes. I just leave it with that. The dominant form of organization in practice of companies, at least all those on the normal indices typically have over 100 subsidiaries in any of the countries, be it the CAC 40, the FTSE, the Dow Jones, or the DAX in Germany. And at the same time, it is at the forefront of the transnational law movement, which is a question: how is law developing in a globalized world without real political will to regulate? Even in the financial crisis, somehow globally, a global regulation is somehow difficult. How do the actors do that, really? And it's much more the private initiative, and what poses that as problems. So both from the practical point of view and from the theoretical point of view, in other disciplines at least, you would say it's a very important phenomenon. And at the same time, those who discuss it on the transnational law side have basically two ideas which I want to test from a legal scholar's perspective. And the one is, at the global and the supranational level, the groups of companies are not regulated. That is what is said. I would call that the absence of uniformity hypothesis. And as you know, even on the national levels, which wouldn't function anyhow for such a global players, but even if that function, you have only very few countries which regulate groups of companies, Germany being the most prominent, Brazil, Portugal, now a bit in Italy, and there are little pieces somehow perhaps in case law where you'd say yes, but a little bit only. And the second hypothesis is basically the transnational, but by private parties made, not public law, private party made law is a substitute, or may serve as a substitute, or is an emerging substitute. And inherent in this hypothesis is a superiority of supranational global solution hypothesis. It's better to have a supranational solution, and that would be the second part of the hypothesis, which I would like to test. Now, as I told you, at the EU level, there is at least a little bit of discussion, but the first one, the Forum Européen, basically seen outside Germany as a very German enterprise, and the reflection group, there was not an awful lot of reaction to the proposals there. Now, in order to make clear what is really the law of groups of companies, I would distinguish different moments in time and different kinds of regulation, and ask the question whether really all these areas are regulated so poorly, first part of the hypothesis. Now, the three moments in time are one in the beginning and one at the end, and I call them transactions, the regulation of the transaction formation of the group and regulation of the transaction unraveling of the group. And in between you have a status, that is a status where you have the problem of the interplay between the parent company and the subsidiaries, powers to direct, liabilities, the ongoing group relationship. Now, you may have either substantive law rules or you may have information rules. And if you distinguish like that, you would say those now listed in black are the ones where you would say, well, you have at least supranational regulation of a very detailed way. Or perhaps even global standards. Basically, that is for the transaction in the beginning, the takeover directive, where you would say it's an EU standard, really. There you have diversity with the US. The two main things of the takeover directive is that whoever makes it, a public takeover bid has to make it to all outstanding shareholders, the mandatory bid requirement, and at the same time the directors of the target company are subject to a anti-frustration rule or a neutrality rule. They may not act within that period of the outstanding bid. That is a European rule. It's not a US-American rule. Delaware does have neither of these two rules. It rather has a rule, well, somehow of reasonableness tested than checked then by the Delaware judiciary. Now, capital market law directives, when I speak about the Volkswagen case, it's mainly the market abuse directive. And there you would say both the insider dealing and the market manipulation branch of it, that you may not deal on insider knowledge and that you may not manipulate prices in an abnormal way, Both parts of that directive are pretty much global standards. US American law, different rules based on the Securities Exchange Act are rather similar, not completely, but rather similar. And that means that if you take market capitalization as an as key factor, you would say it's about 2/3 of the market capitalization worldwide. So you can pretty much speak of a global standard you have here. Of course, on the information side, you would say, moreover, you also have already at this stage the International Financial Reporting Standards, but I will come back to that a bit later. Same thing a bit at the end. I won't speak about the end, but nevertheless, the squeeze-out situation is basically if you have 5% of the stock outstanding in some countries, 10% of the stock outstanding, both sides, either the shareholder still outstanding and the company, if it's publicly listed, can squeeze out the shareholders. That is, again, a U.S.-American development which has now found its way into EU legislation and therefore is a European standard as well. And there is the insolvency regulation, which is a regulation at the EU, but is not a substantive law regulation, but a conflict of laws regulation, and therefore just says, apply the law of where you have the insolvency proceedings, and it then attributes the jurisdiction to the different courts, but it's not a uniform substantive standard, although the regulation, of course, applies in all Europe. Now, all this, you would say, there are pieces of European standards or even global standards, and they are pretty important in the real world of transnational groups of companies. Now comes the relation, and the relation there, you would say, there is a sharp difference between whether you speak about the information on the group or the real life of the group, the instructions given, the liability for debts incurred at several levels. And you would say for the information on the group, you have, again, a global standard, and that is the International Financial Reporting Standards. And that is one of the masterpieces of this idea of transnational law, because it's private party made. And it has a beautiful procedural thing about it, and that is basically that you see that it has been enacted in a way in order to bring in all affected parties in some way or another, so in a certain sense democratically. Now, the same is not true with the substantive law rules. There you have a free flow of national laws and few national laws, really. You may have regulatory competition. There are contractual arrangements within the concept of markets within firms. So competition within this large group of companies, incentive mechanisms, but certainly no uniform standards, really. But all that shows us that, yes, you have one piece of transnational law which is well established, that is on the information side, and you would say, well, it's another kind of legislation, but the democracy concerns and so on, the constitutional concerns which many have when they hear transnational law are perhaps taken care of in this respect. And the other field is the only one where you would see, yes, there is this diversity of transnational law that you don't really know how things function in and how is the interplay. All that shows that, yes, it's important, the transnational law approach, but only in certain areas. And one last thing before we see the cases in the second part of the talk is perhaps, if you take those areas heavily regulated, and I would say the squeeze out is important, the takeover directive, but the capital market law directives as well, you have one trend which is inherent in all that scheme. That is, basically the idea is try to take out as many of the stakeholders apart from the parent and the subsidiary, outstanding shareholders, perhaps even creditors, and give them a chance to just pull out of this situation, and then you can leave the ongoing relationship as something which is really a relationship only between parent and subsidiary, no outstanding shareholders any longer, and therefore it's much easier to regulate, and you don't even have to regulate. That is, you regulate more heavily the moment of formation of the group, and there you take into account all those concerns, for instance, of the minority shareholder by giving the minority shareholder the mandatory bid and being able to liquidate his investment. Or at the same time, at the end, with the squeeze-out provision, if it's a shareholder who is in very small minority as against the parent company, to pull out as well. So it's a sell-out and a squeeze-out regulation you have there. That is that internationally or globally, or even globally, for the takeover directive at the EU level, for the squeeze-out perhaps even globally, you have this idea of privatizing the ongoing relationship. And therefore, you can, of course, have much more of contractual relationships, and you don't need so much of a public regulation for this relationship, for the as it is typically a 100% parent subsidiary relationship. And in fact, if you take those different indices and if you look through them, over 90% of all subsidiaries are 100% subsidiaries. In different countries, if you take all those listed companies in the indices, you have between 2 or 3% and 10% of those companies who have other than 100% subsidiaries. That means only rather few subsidiaries have this problem of outstanding stock, of outstanding, as well somehow the problem of creditor protection. Now, the first part of the hypothesis was there is little or there no global regulation, which is not true really if you see it differently, if you see the transactions at the beginning and at the end as well. The second part of the hypothesis was that if you regulate globally or at least at the EU level, you take care of the problems of transnational groups of companies in a better way than the free float you have now nowadays. Now, I can't test that, of course, for the ongoing relationship because there you don't have a uniform law, but I want to show you that to a certain extent there are cases where the uniform regulation is problematic as well and did not function at all. And the Volkswagen case is a beautiful case, although it would be paradigmatic for many ideas inherent in the different EU regulations. The value ratio between Porsche, which is a very fast car, and Volkswagen, which is a huge company, the value ratio was 1 to 15. Volkswagen being 15 times as big, and therefore Porsche had been virtually insolvent at the end of the 80s of last century, and then Wittekind, a very dynamic CEO, made it very profitable, and that is the paradigm of the market for corporate control. It's the knowledge of one manager given to another firm or offered somehow to the shareholders of another firm, and then they can make their own enterprise much more efficient by taking this one manager. That was the and it may be very small, the company taking over, and very big, the company taken over. So it was a beautiful case exactly for that paradigm. Now, the other thing is, of course, you must earn the money in order to buy, really. You can't do that on a credit basis, only 15 times as big. And what Wittekind and his financial manager mainly did, they wanted to earn it on informed speculation. And that within the framework of capital market law, as I explained it. And the main steps and the financial crisis played a major role in that were basically the following. Porsche in 2005 bought 20% of Volkswagen. At that time, Volkswagen, the stock price of Volkswagen was not very high, was decently high, but not very high. And that was basically because you had the Volkswagen law, and you knew basically the Volkswagen law was designed like that, that you may vote only 20% of your stock. So it's a voting cap. And you had one shareholder already in there, which was the Land of Niedersachsen, and they wouldn't accept, for instance, that you change the seat or that you lay off a lot of the employees, and therefore you knew that actually taking over was not really possible, and therefore Porsche as well said, well, we buy only 20%, and we know about the Volkswagen law. So everybody was calm. Nobody thought that Porsche would take over the Volkswagen. Then they increased to 25%, and 25% is the is in under German law is the threshold from which on nobody may change the the statutes any longer. But that was not really so important. Still, everybody said, well, 25% doesn't change a lot anyhow. You have now one German shareholder, which is Porsche, another one, which is Land, where Volkswagen has its seat as well. So there won't be a takeover. But then slowly, Porsche bought more and more, and somehow never really, neither said we want to take over, nor said we don't want to take over. They said it's sufficient, let a lot of leeway to speculation, what might be the case. Under the Transparency Directive, they had to indicate at certain moments that they had bought a certain share of stock. They had to indicate it again when they passed the threshold of 30%. And now, at that moment, when they had 30%, the takeover directive came in. At that moment, they had to make a mandatory bid to everybody. Why did nobody accept that mandatory bid? Basically, because the stock price had been rather low before, and now it rose. You realized, well, 30%, that may be already, why do they buy 30%? 20%, they can vote only 20%. At that time, Some legal scholars, myself as well, had written that the Volkswagen law was violating European law, and therefore it might be abolished. And then there a court suit was filed as well, and therefore the European Court of Justice would decide on that law, and therefore some kind of takeover imagination came up at that moment. But the stock price, the price for the mandatory bid was that from before and not the one of the future. So nobody made, nobody accepted the bid. What did that mean? Well, for 1 year, Porsche didn't have to make a new mandatory bid, and they could continue buying. And at that moment, what they did is basically they said, well, but 30% now, we will reduce it perhaps again. Now the stock price fell, and whenever it had fallen, Porsche bought again. And all of a sudden, at the end of that year, and when the price rose, Porsche resold. So they earned on that, basically. Now the gains, 2007 and 2008, they had a turnover of about 7 billion with their cars, and a gain of about 1 billion, which is already a very good ratio, from that operative business. But they had gains, overall gains, of nearly 9 billion. And the 8 billion were basically from speculation here, that whenever the stock, you knew that the market was nervous, so whenever the price fell, they resold, they bought, and when it rose, they resold several times and during a few months. And then in October 2007, they attacked the law themselves and said, yes, there is a concrete possibility that we want to take over. Now the stock price rose by 10, basically, because they had a lot of call options, and the market was very, very narrow, and they earned basically out of those 8 billion, they earned within 1 month basically 5 billion. So you have, what do you have really? Now, they had, of course, made quite some debts as well at that moment, about 9 billion as well for buying stock. And now came the financial crisis and the credit crunch, and they didn't get credit any longer. And that was the only reason why the takeover by Porsche from Volkswagen did not succeed, perhaps. Another reason was as well that somehow the peers around, well, they weren't happy. The Deutsche Bank fund, the DSF, said, that is not serious business. And BASF, one of the very, was the manager of the year at that time, said, well, that doesn't have to do with the real world. So it seemed in a certain moment that not just economic criteria, but that idea of social embeddedness, the term of Kranovetter, was really important. All of a sudden, banks said, well, it's tricky to extend credit any longer. And then came the credit crunch, really. And all of a sudden, of course, you cannot cover a debt of 9 billion with an income of 1 billion, which you make on your cars. You can cover it only on the speculation income. And as of 2007, the speculation income was not possible any longer, because then it was clear there was the direct attack by Porsche. Which means that at the end, in order to have all the money which in the accounts, Volkswagen had a lot of money in the accounts, they basically, what took place was a reverse takeover, where Volkswagen paid the debts of Porsche, the 9 billion euro of debts, but took over as well the shares of Porsche, and it went just the other way around. Now, what does that tell us? Well, I think it tells us that had there been the Delaware takeover regime, it might have run quite differently. It is true that possibly this was a case of market manipulation. It was not an insider case, an insider dealing case, because they didn't trade on positive knowledge of anything around. They knew everybody was unsure. That was the only thing. It may be that these were abnormal prices, and there are proceedings now on the basis of market manipulation, but it's very contested whether it was really market manipulation or not. A Delaware court would probably have said, well, in this case, it's reasonable that Volkswagen takes defensive measures, which under EU law, it was not possible, but there was this anti-frustration rule. It would have been perhaps more insecure for Porsche to do all that, and it would be, it may well be that here, a rather clear-cut regime as we have it, and a global regime, did not do the job, and a European regime as well did fail. So it is by no means clear that globalizing or Europeanizing the rules within a group of companies always is the superior solution. I do not say that it is necessarily inferior in all cases, but I plead for a case-by-case analysis. Now, I have perhaps 5 more minutes left in order to leave some time as well for the discussion, and run through the other two cases in parallel. The other two cases are cases on the ongoing relationship. The one is the takeover, or the merger, actually, by Daimler Chrysler, and the other one is the Siemens case. Both are characterized by the willingness to list at the New York Stock Exchange of these two companies in 1993, Daimler, and in 2001, Siemens. What was the reason for this listing? Basically, the reason for this listing, there were many reasons for this listing. One was image. A major one in the Daimler case was that by listing at the New York Stock Exchange, German law at a certain moment allowed Daimler to make accounts only on the basis of US GAAP at that time, now International Financial Reporting Standards, and that because of the accounting rules and the fair value principle allowed other type of accounts. The assets were re-evaluated at present value, and that made it that the balance sheet, the overall balance sheet sum of Daimler rose by 1.8, basically. That was very important for a merger because, of course, you take the two companies and then you evaluate the relative value of each of them, and if the value is 1.8 times of what it was before, once you have the same standards applied, the US GAAP standards, of course the relationship is a different one than if you took the German accounting standards or the European accounting standards at that time. Then Daimler was the bigger company, and they had two CEOs for a certain while, but Eaton, early after the wedding in heaven, as it was called in 1998, withdrew, and then it was basically, Chrysler was basically run like a subsidiary of Daimler's. You had the introduction of the International Financial Reporting Standards, and at a certain moment, the merger, produced a huge turnover, the world's largest turnover, but not a lot of gains. Gains really fell, whereas the turnover was bigger, and that led basically to the demerger. It was never seen as from the from the income perspective as a successful merger. Now, what happened, at the end, Daimler even delisted as many other German companies from the New York Stock Exchange. Now, this story is basically one of the 90s, and then of the 2000, the beginning this decade, where at the beginning you have this story of facilitating the listing at the New York Stock Exchange, and European law as well tried to facilitate that by adopting international financial reporting standards, which are close to US GAAP. So an accounting system which is global. This facilitation was due to the will that European companies should acquire a certain image and resale power in the US. What it did, however, was it made applicable all US law as well, and that is shown particularly beautifully in the Siemens case, where listing took place in 2001, and then in 2006 and 2007, it became evident that Siemens had cases of corruption in many countries, among them Brazil, Argentina, etc., etc. And even to those cases, the US anti-corruption laws applied. We had them to a certain extent already in Germany as well. Brazil and Argentina would have had them much less. And what was the outcome of that? Well, in 2007, most of the German financial newspapers forecasted a total breakdown of Siemens because US law now applied all over for all relationships, group relationships all over in the world, and you have fines up to 2010 of 2.5 billion. Which is not so extraordinary. One thought that it would be still more, but why did Siemens survive nevertheless? Well, that is interesting for the transnational group relationships. What they did is basically they hired as one of the board members responsible for compliance, for anti-corruption, and law more generally, also for the market in the US, a US-American manager, Solmsen, from General Electric. So they took a very aggressive and positive way of signaling, we understand that and our corruption practices were completely wrong, we totally change our image now. And what they did a kind of codes of best practice, which on the basis of contract law, basically, imposed on all their suppliers, on all their contractual partners, and on all their managers in the subsidiaries. And that made an image, and they published that very very aggressively, and that changed completely the image that, of course, they had to pay the fines, but at the same time, the image of the firm was so much changed, everybody knew that corruption was absolutely impossible in that case, that overall in 2012, as compared with the beginning of the crisis, 2007, the gains had tripled. Now, this shows beautifully the interaction of no company law within the ongoing relationship and contractual methods and certain competitive elements between the different subsidiary introduced in this transnational group. Now, the lessons to be derived perhaps very shortly. I think the idea that the transnational group of companies, and perhaps I just skip all the rest and say two or three phrases at the end, the transnational group of companies is, yes, a legal phenomenon where a certain part is not regulated internationally and even not regulated nationally. It's an important part, and in this part, transnational law mechanisms, that is a mixture of different types of rule setters and of legal mechanisms which you employ, codes of best practice or contracts, etc., play a major role. But this part is possible, that this part is regulated so little, that is made possible only because this part is basically prepared, or this part is embedded in a regulatory scheme which regulates rather heavily the beginning and the end of this relationship, that is the formation and the unraveling of the group, and these parts are globally regulated. At the same time, you would say not necessarily a global regulation an EU regulation reaches the goal of legal stability, of forecasting easily the results, more easily than in a transnational and free-float setting. It reaches so that both the hypothesis of a non-existing global regulation and the hypothesis of a superiority of a global regulation are by no means so clear as typically the proponents of transnational law development hold. On the other hand, those proponents have well marked that, or well explained that indeed the transnational group of companies may perhaps not be a focus of national or even global regulation, but it is an area worthwhile thinking and investigating, if not on the company law side, then on the side of combined company law, contract law, and also social norms. Many thanks. Thank you.